Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. We offer guitar repair of the highest quality. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another great podcast at SlysOffice.com. Joining me now, criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff. Casey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sly. Good to be with you.
All right, so this Brendan Dassey situation, can we kind of do a thumbnail sketch of how he got mixed up in the whole Stephen Avery murder case? Let's take it back from the beginning just so people have a understanding of how this happened.
Sure. Well, Brendan Dassey is the nephew of Stephen Avery. In the Stephen Avery trial that's now been made sort of famous by the Making a Murderer documentary, Mr. Dassey was the nephew. He was alleged to have been with Stephen Avery on the date of the incident, and it was also alleged by prosecutors that he essentially participated or at least stood by during the murder of Teresa Halbach, and also that he participated in some way in the rape of Teresa Halbach in this bedroom inside of the Avery property. Now, Dassey was interrogated by officers, and as a part of that interrogation, that was really the subject of an appeal in what we call a federal habeas petition, which is essentially a last-ditch effort after the state appeals have been exhausted to try to get some relief for Dassey, who was incarcerated for decades and decades and decades, or is set to be incarcerated for that amount of time. So the federal habeas petition alleged that Dassey's confession to investigators was essentially coerced and involuntary. And one of the big things that was really looked at, Sly, in this whole Making a Murderer documentary that focused on was the way in which the interrogators interrogated Mr. Dassey, making him promises, suggesting to him that he could perhaps go home and back to school after he was interrogated. There were all kinds of coercive pressures, in my opinion, that were put on a 16-year-old kid who had some, you know, I don't want to say he wasn't as smart as the average 16-year-old kid. And so when you put those kinds of pressures on him, you really kind of call into question a lot of what was happening. In other words, Mr. Dassey, in terms of his confession or so-called confession, was saying things and agreeing with the investigators in direct questioning that things that actually didn't necessarily happen. And so the way in which he was interrogated was extremely controversial, and if you didn't feel badly for Avery and you think that he's guilty, many people that I have spoken with felt terrible for this 16-year-old kid that was put through this entire thing. The state's case essentially rested on Mr. Dassey entirely, or nearly entirely, on his so-called confession, and a federal judge found his confession to be involuntary and coerced. And so what he did is he threw the confession out and granted the habeas petition, ordering just this week the release of Brendan Dassey from prison. And so what Brad Schimmel has done, the Attorney General Brad Schimmel, is they filed an emergency stay order with the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals asking them to order that Brendan Dassey be incarcerated while this appeal is pending, rather than be released, as was ordered by this the lower court district judge, that he be released. Now, he would have to be under the supervision of the United States probation and parole, essentially, and he would be under very, very strict conditions. But I think the judge felt that, based upon this confession, that he ought to be released because he already overturned the conviction, and this whole appellate process could go on for a very, very long time. So now they're fighting his release. He has not been released as of right now, but he may be in the very, very near future.
Wisconsin criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff with us at slysoffice.com. We're talking about the Brendan Dassey case and whether he will be actually released from jail now, because he's been released from the Columbia County Correctional Facility and moved to a jail, correct? Is that right?
I believe that's right, but okay. He has not been released from custody.
Custody, okay. Well, let me play a little bit of the conversation they had on WFRV Television 5, the CBS affiliate in the Fox Valley.
Dassey and Avery families await a formal appeal from the State Department of Justice. How did we get here? Local 5's Terry Kovarik spoke with an attorney who's followed this case closely.
And Terry joins us now live in the studio with what he had to say. Terry.
Tom and Aaron, during the Dassey-Avery trials, Robert Bellin served as an analyst for Local 5. Nearly 10 years later, Bellin says the judge's order ordering Brendan released from prison was like the order overturning his conviction came after careful consideration of the evidence. Judge William Duffin's decision overturning Brendan Dassey's murder conviction was based in part on investigators' promises that Dassey would not face prosecution in exchange for his confession. Robert Bellin served as Local 5's legal analyst during the trial and says that confession was flimsy at best.
There was, you know, Mr. Dassey's confession, which most people saw thought it was ridiculous. But without that, without Mr. Dassey's own words, they really had nothing on him.
Bellin says Judge Duffin's thorough review of all the evidence, including the confession, led him to conclude that Dassey's conviction should be overturned and to order his release from prison.
Both decisions, you've got 110 pages of decisions written by this judge to allow Mr. Dassey his release here. And I think that shows to me that this court truly believes that Mr. Dassey's constitutional rights were violated.
Bellin said the judge's reviews made it harder for the state to prove that Dassey should remain in prison to protect the public interest.
What I saw in that order was that, you know, he's saying, you need to give me something specific about this case and this individual, and you failed to do that, so you didn't meet your burden.
But Bellin says whichever way the Dassey case goes, it won't impact Stephen Avery's case.
The evidence against Mr. Avery was like mountains compared to what there was against Mr. Dassey.
All right. So they don't, if there was a rape, wouldn't they have some sort of DNA? Wouldn't they have something on Brendan Dassey?
Well, a lot of times, I mean, that was at the beginning, this case of, well, I don't want to say the beginning, but it was in the sort of earlier stages of DNA evidence, and DNA evidence certainly has, over the last 10 years, improved substantially. But you're right. I mean, this is a case where you have a simple, you have something very simple on the part of Mr. Dassey, and that is his so-called confession, and whether you believe that was coerced or voluntary. And for people who say, well, I still think he was guilty because why would he admit to this kind of stuff, you really have to read up on false confessions and how they happen and how people who have been exonerated.
How do false confessions happen?
Well, they happen by natural pressures. I mean, especially in a case like this, if you are promising somebody that they will not be prosecuted or suggesting that if they give you an answer, especially in a murder case, that has a tremendous amount of pressure. And you might think, well, I would never confess to something I didn't do. Just look at the DNA exoneration of people that have originally confessed to crimes they did not commit. And it's a much greater pressure in high profile and very serious cases like a murder case. Because if you think you're not going to be prosecuted, and that's something that officers tell you, you're going to rely on that, especially as somebody who's never been in the criminal justice system before. And while you may not admit to something, you may, especially if you have a lower IQ, especially if you're a younger kid, especially if your brain is not developed. Like, we know that people up until the age of 25, in general, their brains are not fully developed at that point. You know, so there are all kinds of ways that this can happen, and we know it happens. We know it happens because we have DNA on it, evidence exonerating people who falsely confess to crimes that are unthinkable, that we would never think that they could possibly do. And, you know, in this case, what we have is we have a confession that was essentially deemed coerced and involuntary. The ends do not justify the means, even if he is factually guilty, which we don't know and we will never know. The only evidence that the prosecution really had overwhelmingly was this confession. And if that is involuntary, if that is coerced, they have nothing else. We can guess about whether he's guilty, but we never want to guess somebody into a lifetime or decades in prison. And I think that's the main point of this. And he really, I mean, you could talk about how he's a flight risk, but this guy has no, as far as I know, he has no ties really or substantial ties outside of Wisconsin. His family lives in Wisconsin. You know, this case is going to have to be, in all likelihood, retried, if at all, unless the Seventh Circuit overturns the lower court judge's decision and finds that this confession was not involuntary. And if he's out on probation and being monitored by probation everywhere that he goes, I don't see him as a flight risk.
All right, so the judge asked Attorney General Schimmel to put up or shut up to show that he was some sort of danger to the community. Evidently, Schimmel has not satisfied the judge's request.
Right. And what he's doing is he's making, Schimmel is, in my opinion, sort of making an emotional plea. He's saying, in part, his order says, Dassey confessed to extremely violent offenses, and a jury unanimously found him guilty of first-degree intentional homicide. He talks about the effect that this will have on the Halbach family, but that's really not a consideration in terms of whether he will be a danger to the community. Unless he has some sort of evidence that he's going to be a danger to the Halbach family themselves, and certainly I guess you can argue, well, you know, if we believe that he participated in the murder of Teresa Halbach, then maybe he'll be a danger to the Halbach family, but there simply isn't any evidence of that. And so when you are, when somebody is awaiting, this is slide, this is always the analogy I draw. There are a lot of people that are awaiting trial who have not been convicted of anything, that are awaiting trial in jail, and the only reason that they really can't get out is because they don't have the money to post bail. And sometimes these people sit for a year or 2 years while they are supposed to be deemed innocent or presumed innocent, but they're sitting in jail. So we have this, I think, a great over-reliance on erring on the side of keeping people in jail and in prison when either their convictions have been overturned, like in the Dassey case, or when they've been convicted of nothing, like people that are awaiting to have their trials and to have a judge determine their guilt.
Casey Hoff with us. We're on slysoffice.com. Be sure to download your podcasts every day. So here's the question for you, and I know this is kind of a tough estimate to make. Are Brad Schimmel's chances of overturning this judge's ruling better than his chances of retrying Brendan Dassey and getting a conviction?
Yeah, I would say at this point they are better. His chances are better at getting the Seventh Circuit to overturn the lower court's decision than they are at retrying him, because if they retry him and if that confession is not admissible, and we've had a lot of, you know, we've had a lot of social science research in the last 10 years on the unreliability of these types of coerced confessions. We had them before, but we have a lot more now. So if that confession is out, I think their chances of retrying him successfully are extraordinarily low. I don't know what they would, what evidence they would use against him if they don't have the confession. I think, you know, Schimmel's, and that's why I predict that if the Seventh Circuit upholds the fact that the confession was involuntary and therefore is inadmissible, I don't think they're going to retry.
You know, it's interesting. Brad Schimmel has a case before the Supreme Court where they're trying to block training tapes that he made from being released in front of prosecutors, where it's alleged that he made insensitive and racial jokes or dialects in front of the attorneys. That's in front of the state Supreme Court right now. So a lot of people say he was sending a bad message to those district attorneys that day. Is his defense of the prosecution of Brendan Dassey a bad message to prosecutors and to police that this sort of interrogation is acceptable?
Well, I would certainly argue that it is, because I think that the amount that we know in terms of the evidence, the overwhelming social science and a plethora of research on involuntary confession suggests that this was an involuntary confession and that it's wrong. I mean, it would be one thing if Brad Schimmel were saying, and perhaps he's going to argue this, I don't know. You know, we do know a lot about these involuntary confessions. They are wrong. we should not do things, and we admit that the investigating officers in the Brendan Dassey case did not do exactly what we wanted them to do, and certainly could have performed a more reliable interrogation. However, we believe, based on the totality of the circumstances in this case, that although they did certain things that were wrong, that we think that this confession is still a voluntary confession. That would be one thing if he phrased it that way. If he's going to say and sanction everything that they did in terms of these interrogations, then I think that sends a bad message and the wrong message.
Wouldn't it be fair to say then, Counselor, he doesn't have an obligation to appeal this case or even keep Brendan Dassey incarcerated, that an attorney general's job is to make sure that justice is done in Wisconsin, not always protect the hubris of law enforcement or a circuit court in a small county?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, prosecutors have a job to seek justice, and there's a lot of different definitions as to what that means. But what we do know that it certainly does not mean is it does not mean that prosecutors have a different role than defense attorneys like myself. Defense attorneys like myself have a role, and we certainly have to be truthful. We also have a role to vigorously defend our clients by any lawful and legal means and ethical means necessary. And whereas prosecutors have a little bit more of a, hey, we're going to step back and look at this. And even though we may feel that this person is guilty or innocent, we have to do what's right for justice. And you know, you've heard of the phrase, it's better to let 10 guilty men go free than one innocent suffer. And I'm not saying that Brendan Dassey is innocent. I don't know. Again, I've said that all along. But based on this confession and based on this interrogation, it was such a, in my opinion, badly done and poorly executed confession and coercive one that I think you should take a second look at this.
All right, let's talk about another case. We'll keep this one pretty brief, but the conviction of Ross Harris in suburban Atlanta with his boy dying in the back seat of his car while he was at work for Home Depot. Let me play a little bit of this. It's from WXIA 11 Alive Television, the NBC affiliate in Atlanta.
As they left the courthouse, this was a decision for them, but in the end, all 12 jurors agreed Ross Harris was guilty on all 8 counts.
They were very diligent, and speaking with them, they were almost unanimous early on.
Prosecutor Chuck Boring says all 12 jurors knew they wanted to convict Ross Harris on malice murder, but they wanted to be sure of their decision.
I really have to tip my hat to these jurors. They were honestly just amazing.
Legal expert John Phillips says the jury was clearly passionate about their decision, and this was an emotional case.
A jury will react with their hearts, and there were parents on this jury, and you had a tragic loss of a child, and you know, it wasn't just whether or not the dad, you know, Mr. Harris was guilty of that, but it was some of the sexting allegations, and it was just so morose that I think they would have, if there had been more charges, they'd have probably found them guilty of that as well.
At the end of the trial, the judge thanked the jurors for their diligence during this trial. She said she would keep them informed as to what the sentencing was going to be because all of them were so invested during the entire trial. She says she was sure they would want to know the outcome. Reporting in Brunswick, Caitlin Ross, 11 Alive News.
Meantime tonight.
You know, those comments from that prosecutor really tell me that media and the coverage of this case before the trial had a huge impact on this conviction.
Absolutely. And you hear the prosecutor talking about the emotions of these jurors. You know, we're supposed to decide cases based on facts, and I don't pretend that people's emotions don't come into it. But you heard the prosecutor talk not only about the emotions, but also about these sexting allegations and things like that. There is a ban, a general ban in the rules of evidence on character evidence, because we don't want jurors to be deciding someone's guilt or innocence based on the character of that individual. We want them to decide it based on the facts, and the facts in this case involve leaving the son in this hot car and whether or not he did that with some sort of malice in his heart. That was really the ultimate question that the jury had to decide. And one of the troubling things that I'm listening to as I'm hearing this prosecutor is he's talking about the emotions of these jurors, and he's really focusing on this guy's character. And that's supposed to be things, those are supposed to be things that we're not supposed to consider, because we don't want to be making a mistake in these types of situations. But what the prosecutor did in addition to that is he introduced this text message, and I think that was really the one of the main things I imagine in terms of what tipped this case, is that, you know, he talked about how, and I forget exactly what the prosecutor's text left, but it was something like, I love my son and all, but we both need escapes. And that was something that the district attorney's office introduced and that they allege happened just minutes before he left his vehicle.
But, now, you know, that doesn't seem Sherman-esque to me.
No. And I think what that is that would be understandable why that would be allowed into evidence. But then near the end of the trial, they talk about how he was a sex-addicted man with a compromised marriage, and they're introducing evidence relating to that. And that really, to me, goes to the heart of, we're saying that this is a bad guy. And because this is a bad guy, we think you ought to convict him of this. And you even heard the prosecutor say it in those remarks, that had we stacked up additional charges, well, I think the jury would have convicted him of those too, because they were so disgusted by him. You know, that's, you're playing with, I think, a dangerous situation there.
Well, yeah, this guy had all the charm of Jared from Subway. All right, so he wasn't exactly an endearing figure. But, you know, you're a parent. Any parent could do this. You like to think that it couldn't happen to you, but because car seats have to go in the back now, any parent could do this. They say the jurors didn't believe his story. So the onus, when you make a mistake like this, is, I guess, the plausibility of what happened. Well, it's not, you know, just out of the gate, you're behind the eight ball, because it doesn't seem like it's plausible that anyone would forget about their child in a car. But it happens,
right?
And we know that in most cases, it happens as an honest accident.
Right, and we know that there were at least 39 children in the U.S. this year that have died of this, what they term vehicular heat stroke. And it's a very, very sad situation. And those are just the children who died. It doesn't count the many more that were left in the car. And then the parents realized it shortly thereafter and go back and go, oh, my God. Well, this guy in this particular case, if you believe the jury, they apparently believe that he acted with malice and that he had malice in his heart when he did this, that he essentially intended for his son to die. And so, you know, these are very, very difficult cases. But what I'm troubled by is this increasingly, you know, and it really is, I don't mean politically liberal, but just sort of a liberal in the sense that it's becoming more and more acceptable, it seems to me, across the country by different judges to allow this so-called character evidence in. And
character evidence usually can come in when someone is sentenced. Is that correct?
Sure. Yes, a judge actually does consider somebody's character when they're sentenced, right. But a jury is supposed to consider the facts before them. Mm-hmm. Now, there are exceptions to character evidence. For example, in Wisconsin, if someone has an opinion about someone being an untruthful person, that can sometimes come in. Or if somebody acted with a similar modus operandi in other situations, let's say that this guy had, in other very similar situations, left
right.
his other kid. I don't know if he
right.
has one in a car. Well, that can arguably
right.
come in. But this is. Hey, this guy's a sex addict. This guy is a sex fiend, and we, you know, we want you to hate him before the evidence even comes in. And I find that problematic.
All right, the prosecutors did not go for the death penalty in this case, even though they could have. They didn't feel like it reached that level. They could get a conviction on that. You can second guess me here. This sure looks to me like a case that's going to be appealed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this guy's 35 years old. You know, he's facing, he will probably get decades and decades in prison. And so, yeah, I mean, I think this is definitely going to be a case that you're going to see an appellate process go through on.
All right. Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff, if somebody needs some legal advice, they get themselves in trouble in Wisconsin, what's the number to call?
920-234-2222.
All right. Keep downloading those podcasts at slysoffice.com.
Slysoffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.